Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about British actress Emma Thompson, who comes from a family of actors. She was born in Paddington, London, which I mentioned because, you know, in 2014, she actually helped with the Paddington screenplay. So nice little tie-in there. But her mother has co-starred with Emma Thompson in several films. And her father was television presenter Eric Thompson, most famous for being the English narrator of the French animated show The Magic Roundabout. And Emma went to, you know, an all-girls school and then all-women college, eventually going to Cambridge University, where she studied English literature and was part of the university's Footlights group. That's important for two reasons. One, she has this sort of bookish background. And secondly, because she met so many people there that she ended up having professional relationships with. It's worth noting, too, that this is also where many of the Monty Python members had first met. So it's always interesting, Mike, how so many people who end up in theater and movies have a whole group of people that they go through this with, and they all end up, well, not all, but enough of them end up being famous that you have to wonder what the connection is there. How is it timing? Is it just being at the right place at the right time? I don't know how that unfolds. I don't know if you have an opinion about that.
I have a lot of opinions about that. One thing worth noting is a very quick sideline. If you do the American equivalent on our side of the pond, you look at the careers of actors like Kevin Kline, Meryl Streep, on and on, how often, Sigourney Weaver, how often people like that would have met in college. And if they went through like Yale Drama School or whatever, the number of people they work with in college that then they would work with professionally. So there's something really phenomenal about that. And it's a zeitgeist kind of thing. You just have the good fortune to meet those people when you're still in college. But let me quickly double back on Marie's point, because it was such an important one. When Emma Thompson goes to college, and certainly by the time she gets to Cambridge, working not just in college theater, as one would expect, but specifically in comedy troupes, in what we'd call like improv groups even. And in fact, you know, she was part of an all-female improv group and kind of pioneering work there. She would, you know, in her work at Cambridge in theater, work with people like Stephen Fry, you know, people we come to know through other plays and films. And it doubles back on the other or another important point Marie was making, namely, we're going to talk a lot about the versatility of an actor like Emma Thompson. And you can see there's definitely a bookish side to her. And indeed, Shakespeare is like the most important book of all, if you will. And we'll keep coming back to that throughout the show, her work in Shakespeare adaptations. There's that. But also in a lighter vein, which she does have, there is this. And also, let me double back on myself here. In terms of the bookish strain, when she does a lot of the what are called heritage films, you know, based on works of literature, kind of high tone works, there is a bookish quality to a lot of the cinema she does aside from, let's say, Shakespeare plays. There's that bookish side to her, okay? And she has oftentimes a great reserve as an actor there because the character calls for it. But then, again, doubling back now on Marie's point, the college theater training, the improv and so on, you can be silly, you can be goofy, you can have that lighter side to you. And she brings that to, you know, her serious roles to some extent, but then she's done out-and-out comedies, just lighter fare, if you will. And it's really great to watch an actor like that who almost like from project to project, you know, do I go bookish or do I go light of touch here? And then the final observation I'll make by way of that bookish side is, as Marie will be talking about presently, in addition to being an accomplished actor, she's also an accomplished screenwriter. So, you know, reading and writing oftentimes are closely allied, certainly in her career. So I hand it back to you.
Yeah, not only did she make friends with Stephen Fry, but Emma Thompson ends up working with Hugh Laurie as well, and they do a lot of TV work together. And then she sort of segues into her movie career. And I think one of the highlights was, of course, the two Merchant Ivory movies, Howard's End and The Remains of the Day. And then, of course, Much Ado About Nothing. I think we can talk about all three of these together because it's sort of a really short period of time where she makes some very good movies that bring her a lot of accolades. Now, you know, we've already mentioned that she read English literature when she was at Cambridge. And she says, books are like people in that they'll turn up in your life when you most need them. And I like that quote because it really shows how much she values the written material that she has to work with. She received a total of 13 nominations for her role in Howard's End and won in all of those events, which includes an Oscar, a Golden Globe, and a BAFTA as Best Actress. So, you know, what a way to burst onto the scene. Howard's End was one of two movies for Merchant Ivory, the second one being The Remains of the Day. And she's the only person to have won Academy Awards for both acting and writing. She won Best Actress in Howard's End and then would go on to get Best Adapted Screenplay for Sense and Sensibility, which we will get to in a minute. Do you have anything you want to say about Howard's End before we talk about Remains of the Day, Mike?
Before we get to Howard's End, or as we get to it, let's talk a little bit more about what leads up to that. Because, you know, as Marie says, she's out of college, she's getting a lot of TV and stage work, West End theater and so on. And that's the point where she starts working with Kenneth Branagh's theater company, okay, Renaissance Ensemble. And that's important to point out because they have a strong professional and personal connection. They're doing a lot of stage work together. He, of course, is a film director as well as actor. So when he makes Henry V in 1989, she's, you know, part of the cast there. And so they're married and they're working together. And this is where you get some of the high tone Shakespeare adaptations, but he does other stuff too. So I don't want to make it seem like it's all highbrow Shakespeare. And she likewise is alternating the serious early film roles with sillier stuff. She would do The Tall Guy in 1989, the same year. And that's when she starts working with Richard Curtis, a writer that Marie and I talked about in a recent episode. And she and Richard Curtis will work again a few times. So it's just to have that also as part of our groundwork. But this is where she's becoming a public figure. And by public, I mean with the not just the British public, but the American as well. The film she does called The Tall Guy is just a silly comedy. It's released in this country, not a big audience, but people start to notice Richard Curtis and Emma Thompson. And this is the period just before, because Howard's End is 1992. So I'm talking now slightly earlier, late 1980s into the early 90s, if you will. And they become a celebrity couple. Because after all, you know, they're both well-known actors at that point. And in fact, I smiled when I saw a quote from a critic who described them as, quote, a golden couple for the upwardly mobile. And the reason I like that so much is, you know, there's a certain patina there. Even when she's playing silly, there's a kind of wit, there's a cleverness, you know, she's not slumming, let's put it that way. You know, the comedies can be silly and daft, if you will, to use a word that the English would use, they can be daft. But they've got some genuine wit and cleverness behind them. So this is the period leading into Howard's End. The other thing I'd want to say about Howard's End and Remains of the Day and so on, she's working with the Merchant Ivory team, you know, Ishmael Merchant, the producer, James Ivory, the director. This is really high-tone cinema. What's great about it from a film historical perspective is it's firing on it on at least two important cylinders. The one is that bookish quality. It's you know, a lot of production value, you know, esteemed literary sources, really top-notch cast. A lot of production value. As you're watching it, it's just like, oh, you're in the quintessential, you know, British country houses, all that. And I'm not saying that in a diminishing way. I mean, I might sound like I'm slightly snide. I don't mean it that way. I mean, it really looks great on the screen. It has that patina, if you will. And that's where it gets critical recognition and Oscar recognition. As Marie pointed out just a little while ago, you know, she wins the Academy Award as Best Actress. I mean, Howard's End, she has arrived with that film. But also, and this is the second cylinder firing here, commercially, this film does extremely well. So it's not just highbrow critics and Academy Award dispensers and that. It's the general public that really gets to know her. And the reason I harp on that point is, you know, even though I've been indicating a kind of distinction between the highbrow serious stuff, which does, you know, well enough usually at the box office, and the more blatantly commercial or, you know, sillier comedies, that and it's not quite as dichotomous as that. You know, she has a career where a lot of her work hits on both scores. You know, she hits well with the critics and awards and dispensers, also with the public. So let's move on, Marie, up from Howard's End per se, which is certainly one of her best known projects, to the period that comes just after that. And you've already alluded to this with Remains of the Day. In the year 1993, so here we go, a year after Howard's End, she makes three films in that same year. In the Name of the Father, where she receives an Academy Award nomination for Best Supporting Actress, and Much Ado About Nothing, one of her collaborations with Kenneth Branagh, and then Remains of the Day, where she's again Academy Award nominated for Best Actress. And think about that. It's like in a single year to make films that are still remembered well today, that get Oscar nominations, that have her playing all kinds of roles. Occasionally actors have like a golden year or golden period. Somehow everything lined up just right. 1992, 1993. If you didn't know her before, you knew her now.
It also gave her a chance to like establish all the classy stuff. and make a name for herself as a serious actress. And like you said, she was working with Kenneth Branagh, and they made 4 films together before the marriage came apart at the seams. And, you know, The Remains of the Day in particular, people haven't seen it. It's great for the people who like that Downton Abbey kind of story where, you know, what is it like to work in the big manor? What is it, you know, what is the butler's life like? And it, you know, it's about, and it's Anthony Hopkins playing the butler who sacrifices his life in service and kind of ends up not having a relationship that might have worked out. And that's, of course, with Emma Thompson. And she says that, you know, in all the great stories, even if there's a happily ever after ending, there's something sad. And this movie and the book that it's based on render both of those feelings very, very well. But then she gets into part of her career where I think she really gets to stretch out and use her writing skills. So she worked on the script for Sense and Sensibility for years and years. And I always like to tell my students this story because everybody has this happen to them. It's all written on a laptop that then crashes. And so she gets Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie over, and they're all freaking out trying to figure out, how do we get this file back? All that work is on that laptop. And, you know, that sense of, where did my paper go? I think everybody can relate to that. But they did obviously resolve the issues and made this wonderful Ang Lee directed version of the classic Jane Austen story. She also met her husband to be Greg Weiss on the set of this movie. So her second marriage, she actually ends up with the guy who plays Willoughby, the cad. So what did you think of Sense and Sensibility, Mike?
Let me point out that for that film, Sense and Sensibility, Emma Thompson won the Academy Award for Best Adapted Screenplay. She was also nominated for Best Actress in that film. So she got a lot of recognition. It's a rather daunting task when you think about it, to take something like Jane Austen, like Sacred Text, and to adapt that, try it sometime. A novel that runs a few hundred pages, you need to get the essence of it and some of the most famous dialogue, if you will. But then think about the painful decisions about what to leave out. All of the story or backstories you can't possibly get in, even if you do a miniseries. And so it really is an art form unto itself to take a work of art like that and adapt it. Now, she was working with the director Ang Lee, who himself is quite versatile. And he recognized in her the ability to play serious characters, serious films, if you will. But as with Jane Austen has got that, you know, whimsical, satirical quality, too. I mean, it's serious literature, but it has a sense of humor for sure. And I have a brief quote from Ang Lee about how he saw affinities between Emma Thompson and the source novel there, Jane Austen. This is something intuitive. When you're a director, you just have a like gut feeling that the actor/screenwriter gets it. And this is essentially Ang Lee saying that she gets it. So here's what Ang Lee said, quote, "Like Austen, she's laughing at her own culture while she's a part of it." And that's a tricky thing to bring off because, you know, her characters are very much part of that early 19th century society, the values it ascribes to, the way it dresses, all that. She needs to stay in character, basically, right? But that she, the actor, and by extension, of course, the character, has an awareness, a kind of almost, not quite out of body, but an awareness, too, of sometimes how they come across or how silly something might seem. And to be able to convey those things simultaneously, it's, again, something that we feel at a gut level more than something we can even necessarily articulate. But Ang Lee saw that in her. And also, as Marie and I were saying some minutes ago, it seems like centuries ago we've been talking so much, the fact that Emma Thompson's background has both a serious side and a sillier side to it. And there are roles and there are screenwriting occasions when she gets to, you know, frankly, not see that as being quite so, as I said before, dichotomous, but to see, you know, affinities or connections between the two. After all, Shakespeare is very funny. Oftentimes in his most tragic of plays, there's a lot of humor. And so it's a mistake sometimes to box things in entirely as drama or comedy. You know, life itself has elements of both.
That's a really good point to make. I do want to say what is interesting just about your fame happening at the right time is that Columbia Pictures wanted Emma Thompson to play Eleanor. And I think she makes a really great Eleanor because she was coming off of her Oscar win for Howard's End. But the original plan was that Natasha Richardson and Jolie Richardson would play the Dashwood sisters. And that's sort of a missed opportunity, I think, because having those two famous sisters play sisters in this classic film would have been really interesting. But I think, you know, it's got Emma Thompson all over it. So, I mean, it's not like we're missing out. When we get to 2001, she also does some more writing on a movie called Wit. Now, the story of Wit is about a renowned professor who's forced to reassess her life when she's diagnosed with terminal ovarian cancer. And it's directed by Mike Nichols, and it is based on a Pulitzer Prize drama, which won in 1999. And this movie is often shown at medical colleges as an example of how doctors and researchers should not behave. And I want to say I can see that intent in there, because what is so difficult about watching this is that I am myself a professor, and you could just sort of really see how awful it was, terrible to have cancer anyway. But her doctor is one of her former students, and just the slow slide of humiliating things that happen, the loss of dignity, is just very well handled in the story. Very hard to watch, because it's just the inevitability of decline. You can't stop it. And people who used to respect you are now seeing you at your absolute worst and, you know, talking about you in the third person. It's just a really, really tough movie to watch, but powerful. What did you think of it, Mike?
Well, I had actually seen the original stage play. So I had read the play when it first came out, and I saw it on stage, so I knew the material. And Marie, you stated it so well. It's really difficult material, and it's really bracingly honest. You know, it doesn't cheat. It's like a close-up. It's like a tight focus on something where, even though you don't want to watch it, you can't look away. It's just, you know, it pulls you into that, and you have to confront, you know, the issues that you've so well identified here. And I thought the film had that same merit, that same value, that it didn't cut corners or try to somehow make it lighter than what it was, because this is really heavy-duty material. And you just got to go with it. If you're going to do something like Wit, you got to go with it. You know what I mean? You don't want to turn it into like the most cheerful film of the year, because it's not. And so among her more serious films, I think that's certainly one we are entitled, not just entitled to talk about, but need to talk about. So this is, again, a period in her career when she's won Oscars. She's so well known. Let me hand it back to you at this point, because she starts to do some work in this period that is, when I say blatantly commercial, I don't mean that in a you know, demeaning way, but just simply that, you know, she's making films in Britain that get distributed in the US. She's also making out and out Hollywood films. That's essentially what I'm getting at. The box office films, let's call them. So the general public certainly knows her, and she's having a good time with films like this. So let me have you describe that good time.
Well, I want to mention that for Wit, she shaved her head, you know, to be totally in the character. And I think where you're leading me is to one of my favorite films ever in 2003, Love Actually, which is an ensemble piece. And I'm a sucker for an ensemble piece. I love the way people's lives sort of fit together. I like the trade-off between the characters. The caliber of actors that are in it is just beyond belief. All four leading stars of Sense and Sensibility technically appeared in this movie, with Hugh Grant, Emma Thompson, and Alan Rickman playing roles, and Kate Winslet appearing in stock footage of Titanic. This movie, I think, is one of the reasons why her appeal is so ongoing. She plays such a sympathetic character. She's married to Alan Rickman, who's cheating on her. And she wears a fat suit so that she, you know, appears to be a heavier, middle-aged woman. But she's so sympathetic in the film, to the point that every year when people watch it over, they're like, maybe this time Alan Rickman won't cheat on her, and, you know, it'll have a happier ending for one of the most likable characters in it. Following that, of course, you know, we have to mention that in 2004, she appears in Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban. Professor Trelawney, again, mining that renowned professor vein, and she took that job to impress her daughter. I'm sure for every actor who does a movie that's meant for a younger audience, there's somebody in there that, you know, like a child or a nephew, somebody that they hope to be relevant with. So she says on her role in the Harry Potter film, I have a nervous breakdown in the film, and in one scene, I get to stand on top of the stairs waving an empty sherry bottle, which is, of course, a typical scene from my daily life, so isn't much of a stretch. And that brings us to, well, we're skipping a lot of years, but in terms of the roles that are people pleasers, in 2013, we get to Saving Mr. Banks, where she plays author P.L. Travers, reflecting on her childhood after reluctantly meeting with Walt Disney, who wants to adapt Mary Poppins for the big screen. Now, Mike, was there anything in between Harry Potter and Saving Mr. Banks you wanted to get in there about Emma Thompson before we talk about that movie?
Just very quickly, when she does the first Harry Potter films, a reminder that she keeps returning to Harry Potter with all those sequels. So she's always before the public in that franchise. But also just after doing the first Harry Potter film, she does Nanny McPhee, which is a big commercial hit, actually. So it should be mentioned quickly that way. But then right on the heels of that, she does the script for an adaptation of Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. She just does the script there. But again, you really see her within the same year, from one year to the next, constantly going from, you know, whether Shakespeare, Jane Austen, you know, that side, if you will, let's throw in the heritage films, the Merchant Ivory stuff she had done, to the other side, which is more box office, more commercial, more comedies, whether it's Richard Curtis, Love Actually, things like that, or as you get into the films Marie and I are talking about right now, where you really see, again, in her career, the ability to constantly go from one to the other. Honestly, a lot of her more recent work is not the strongest that she's done, but it's good, reliable work. I mean, you're always happy to see her on screen. But very quickly, I'll say that Saving Mr. Banks, there is a bit of the Mary Poppins personality there, if you will. You know, she's funny, she's bright, she's smart, she's this, that, she's light on her feet, if you will. I mean, Emma Thompson, you can see that lighter side of Emma Thompson there, someone who would have had fun with a character like that in improv bits. Not that Mr. Banks, you know, is improv, but it has that lighter quality to it oftentimes, a more, let's say, whimsical quality. And certainly she can bring that to her work and does extremely well in that film. It's a very likable film, isn't it?
It's a wonderful film. And, you know, I'm glad you mentioned Nanny McPhee, because she says the nanny story is essentially the Western. It's the stranger from out of town who comes into the situation of conflict, solves the issues using unorthodox methods, and then must depart. Shane and Buffalo Bill turn up as Nanny McPhee and Mary Poppins in the female world. And speaking of being able to provide sort of background wit where you wouldn't necessarily expect it, Bradley Whitford recounted a story about a prank that Emma Thompson played on him and his co-actors during Saving Mr. Banks. Because they were filming a scene in which she was not on screen, Thompson had taken the opportunity to change out of her restrictive costume and into a robe to relax. Whitford was in the middle of a take in which he was singing Let's Go Fly a Kite, and Thompson stood up and opened her robe. Whitford said she was wearing nothing underneath it but two pasties depicting Mickey Mouse. Now, you gotta love a woman like that. That is somebody who knows how to deliver a joke. Coming up to like recent things that she has done, I wanted to mention Late Night, because it was not a great movie, but she gets to play a late night talk show host, and actress, writer, and producer Mindy Kaling wrote the role of Catherine Newbery specifically for Emma Thompson. So it's fun to watch her do a role that, you know, not a lot of people have seen. So you can just sort of, she doesn't have to be quote unquote Emma Thompson. And then the other movie I wanted to mention was called Last Christmas, from 2019. And I wouldn't say this is a great movie. It is, however, the first writing collaboration of Emma Thompson and Greg Wise, her husband. And she plays Amelia Clark's mother in the movie and is unrecognizable for most of it. It's only later that she realizes, oh, wait a minute, that's Emma Thompson. Now, Mike, we are coming up to the end of our show. So where do you want to leave people with Emma Thompson in terms of British film? Because I know you're teaching it coming up in the fall of 2021, and we're actually hoping this will be one of our first back to normal classes in the classroom with the movies that you can choose to show everybody all about British film. So tell everybody, what do you have planned for fall?
Well, I am so looking forward to getting back into the classroom. I just can't wait for that. So anyway, of course, on British cinema, and to tie it into Emma Thompson, I mean, she really is part of a generation of actors who are blessed. They grow up in the post-war years. They have college educations. As we said earlier, they're working in college theater. They go into not just stage work, but TV work that segues into film careers. In recent episodes of our show, Marie and I have talked about other British actors who, in some cases, might be a little older, a little younger, but still that sense of opportunity these people have. And the fact that a further opportunity is they're appearing in British films that get shown widely, not just in the UK, but across the pond and get shown in the United States. So one reason I was particularly happy to talk about Emma Thompson today is so many of the films we talked about, you know, you go to the local mall theater and you're watching a Harry Potter movie and there she is, right? You could go to an art house like the Charles Theater in Baltimore and see her in some high-tone literary adaptation. She's reaching people in various ways, and she's smart that way. And the versatility we've talked about throughout the show today, the one thing I'll have to add is just kind of a smile-inducing footnote here, is for her as a writer, it's not just screenplay adaptations of Jane Austen and William Shakespeare. She's written two children's books about Peter Rabbit. How's that for high-tone literature?
I think she's just a Renaissance woman. Apparently, she can do it all. Well, that brings us to the end of our episode. Don't forget to check out our other episodes on dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. And we will see you at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.